I'm Veronica Dudo. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, firsthand account. He was on the plane with the Pope during his apostolic visit. Today, he joins us and tells us what happened in public and in private. Coming to America amid conflict and war in the Middle East, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem is heading to the U.S., who he'll visit and what he hopes to accomplish, plus fighting for Christians.
But thanks to God, we are still there.
We'll take you to the special event aimed at helping the persecuted faithful. These stories and more right now.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. Francis Xavier. Our top story tonight, peace, dialogue, and fresh hope for Christian unity. Those are just three of the many takeaways from Pope Leo's apostolic visit to Turkey and Lebanon. EWTN News was with the Pope the entire trip and even had a reporter on the papal plane. We're happy to welcome to the show EWTN News's Elias Turk, a reporter with Asi Mina, a service of EWTN News. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
After covering every stage of Pope Leo XIV's apostolic journey through Turkey and Lebanon, what would you say were the most defining moments that revealed the deeper purpose of this trip?
There were three big moments that stood out to me. First was the ecumenical prayer in Iznik, where the Council of Nicaea once met. Standing there was the Orthodox Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew I and other church leaders highlighted the Holy Father's desire for Christian unity and for healing all divisions. The second moment was his silent prayer at the Beirut port explosion site, I would say. Meeting families of victims showed that his mission was to comfort a nation still wounded by tragedy and injustice. And finally, the Holy Mass at Beirut waterfront, attended by around 150,000 people, revealed his hope to lift a people facing fear and instability, and to call the Lebanese people to unity and peace.
You were there from your perspective as a correspondent on the ground. How do you think the Pope's encounters with political and religious leaders in both countries might influence interreligious relations and regional stability?
Well, Pope Leo met with Turkish and Lebanese political authorities, and he also met with many Christian and Muslim religious leaders in both countries. The encounters were shaped by the same message that he repeated on the plane back to Rome, which is dialogue over violence. The Holy Father explained that he met privately with groups involved in regional conflicts, urging them to lay down weapons and choose negotiation. He also said he had begun speaking with President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu about stopping violence in the Middle East. During the press conference, he also highlighted Lebanon as a model where Christians and Muslims can live together with respect. So his approach suggests that the trip could encourage leaders to see coexistence as realistic, not naive, and to build stability through conversation rather than fear.
Now, Pope Leo placed strong emphasis on Christian unity, as you mentioned, during the trip to Turkey, particularly during the commemorations of Nicaea. How significant were these gestures for relations between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox world?
The Pope's actions in Turkey sent a strong message to the Orthodox world. By commemorating Nicaea and praying with Patriarch Bartholomew I, he renewed the Church's shared commitment to ecumenical dialogue. For years, some feared that dialogue has reached its limits and that no further progress toward unity was possible. But this visit brought fresh hope, especially through the joint declaration that the Pope and the Ecumenical Patriarch issued, and the Pope's warm exchanges with Orthodox leaders. Pope Leo also looked ahead, inviting Christians to work together as we approach the 2033 Jubilee, marking 2,000 years since Christ's redemption. The Holy Father's gestures suggested that full communion is not a dream of the past, but a real possibility for the future.
Elias Turk, thank you so much. Now that the Pope has returned to Rome, analysis examining the potential success of his trip has begun. We spoke with one Catholic scholar who had this to say.
On the anniversary of the Creed of Nicaea, this most foundational
confession of our faith, and it should be the touch point of unity. So I see what the Pope is trying to do is to use this touch point of unity on which we already agree, and then use that as a kind of wedge to produce more fraternity.
It's been noted that the Holy Father declined to pray at the Blue Mosque, but Dr. Hildebrand says that's because the Pope was showing that Christian unity is different and unique from the unity of all people. Ukraine tells Moscow to stop wasting the world's time. This after 5 hours of talks with U.S. envoys at the Kremlin ended without a breakthrough. Kremlin aide Yuri Ushakov says no compromise has been reached on territory, a key issue Moscow says must be settled to move the peace process forward. He admits there's still a lot of work to be done in both Washington and Moscow. Ukraine, for its part, refuses to give up land Russia has taken. Now the big question is, will the Trump administration ramp up pressure on Russia or Ukraine to make concessions? Joining us now to discuss is Andriy Dubryansky, Director of Communications and Media at the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ukraine says Putin is wasting the world's time. Is Russia at the table in good faith or buying time?
I think we saw a lot of wasting time in Moscow, especially with Americans traveling there on behalf of President Trump and having to wait for President Putin even to walk into the room. It's unfortunate, but we do know that progress has been made in terms of ramping up pressure, as you asked earlier. The pressure has been on the Russian oil revenues, and we can report that as of November of this year, oil revenues in Russia have not just been estimated from outside Russia, but earlier this week, Russia has itself confirmed that their oil revenues are 34% lower than they were a year ago this November. So this pressure is what is needed to get Russia to accede to certain points. And that's not the point we're at right now, unfortunately.
Russia insists no peace deal is possible without Ukraine giving up territory. What does that demand tell you about the Kremlin's long-term goals?
Well, it's clearly been the same, especially with President Putin having a speech last week where he said that so long as Ukraine is fighting back, that he is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian. We also heard that President Putin was willing to deploy weapons of mass destruction against Europe if they so willed to start a war against him. It's really this kind of rhetoric that goes against the calls for peace. As you mentioned, the Holy Father praying for this and even meeting with a delegation from the United States led by Senator Amy Klobuchar in the last week, asking for the petition to get children released. There are nearly 20,000 children who've been stolen by Russia during the course of their occupation of Ukrainian territories.
NATO allies now want a formal say in any future peace agreement. Should NATO have a seat at the table, or does that risk escalating tensions further?
Well, what we saw and read in the 28-point plan that was proposed from the United States was mention of NATO, a NATO status for Ukraine, and also where troops could be stationed in NATO countries already. So by default, they should have a say in what happens if they're mentioned in the agreement. Of course, this year, we have a seminal change in the United States support for Ukraine, whereas we are not giving Ukraine any weapons from appropriated monies from the United States. Now all of that is being paid for through the Pearl program, which was initiated by Donald Trump in July of this year, along with the head of NATO. Now NATO has a bigger role as opposed to earlier this year, where the United States was still giving money appropriated, not money, but weapons and artillery appropriated under President Biden.
Andriy Dubryansky, Director of Communications and Media at the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Republicans are breathing a sigh of relief following the results in the special election for the 7th Congressional District. The closely watched race saw Republican Matt Van Epps defeat Democrat Afton Bain in the final unofficial count. This election was a major focus for both national parties with significant last-minute campaigning and high-profile endorsements highlighting the political stakes. The victory secures the open seat for Republicans and sets the stage for future legislative battles in the U.S. House. Several big headlines coming out of the White House tonight. For starters, the Trump administration is halting immigration applications from 19 countries. This includes requests for green cards. It's all part of a sweeping immigration change in the wake of the ambush shooting of two National Guard troops just last week in Washington, D.C. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
The changes are outlined in a memo posted on the website, a policy memo, that is, posted on the website of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and we'll put it on the screen for you right now to take a look at. Now, this is the agency tasked with processing and approving all requests for immigration benefits. Earlier this year, the administration banned travel to the U.S. by citizens of 12 countries and restricted access for those from seven others, citing national security concerns. Included on that list of 19 are Afghanistan, Haiti, Iran, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen, and more. The pause puts on hold a wide range of immigration-related decisions, such as green card applications or naturalizations for immigrants from those 19 countries. Also making headlines, President Trump pardons Texas Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar and his wife in a federal bribery and conspiracy case. President Trump said on Truth Social, the previous administration weaponized the justice system by going after Cuellar for speaking out against open borders. Cuellar addressed reporters.
I want to thank President Trump for this action that he took. On behalf of my wife and my family, I want to say thank you. I think the facts have been very clear about this, but I would also say I want to thank God for standing during this very difficult time with my family and I.
Another major headline coming out of the White House, vehicle mileage rules for the auto industry. President Trump in the Oval Office today proposing to significantly reduce fuel economy requirements through the 2031 model years. It would ease pressure on automakers to control pollution.
Now, under the new rules being issued today by Secretary Duffy, the Department of Transportation will rescind the Biden fuel economy prices. And I hate to say that because they were really not economy. They were really they were anti-economy. They were horrible what they were doing to the costs and actually making the car much worse.
Environmentalists decrying the decision, saying it will hurt the environment by relying on oil. Mileage rules have been implemented since the 1970s, and over time, automakers have gradually increased their vehicle's average efficiency. Now, the president says what he calls under the Green New scam, people are paying too much for cars. He says cars will be environmentally friendly and cost a lot less for Americans. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
The Department of Homeland Security announces it is launching Operation Catahoula Crunch, targeting New Orleans in its latest immigration crackdown. The department says the goal is to arrest individuals who were released after committing crimes, stating that sanctuary policies endanger U.S. cities. Louisiana's governor says the National Guard will also be deployed to aid the efforts. This as federal authorities are preparing a targeted immigration enforcement operation in Minnesota that would primarily focus on Somali immigrants living unlawfully in the U.S. Attacks against law enforcement nationwide is on the rise. Police Association officials told a House panel that anti-police rhetoric is fueling the violence and Congress must pass tougher laws.
The rise in targeted violence and corrosive rhetoric threatens their safety and erodes public trust. We cannot allow this trend to continue. Protecting those who protect us is not a partisan issue. It is a national responsibility.
That nearly one-third of cop killers self-identified as being motivated by the narrative that portrays law enforcement as the villain. That narrative, used for political gain, is amplified across social media platforms and other means, and it all too often goes unchallenged. And it's not harmless rhetoric. It is fuel.
The hearing comes less than a week after two National Guard members, both deployed to Washington, were shot near the White House. According to the FBI, assaults on law enforcement reached a 10-year high in 2023, with more than 79,000 officer attacks reported. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly. The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem is coming to America, where he's going and what he hopes to accomplish. Plus, a new initiative aims to give American children a firm financial foundation, how it works and where the money's from. The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem is making a pastoral visit to the U.S. this week, highlighting the plight of Christians in the Holy Land. Cardinal Pierre Battista Pizzaballa will visit the Archdiocese of Detroit, praying with the largely Middle Eastern Catholic community there. The Archdiocese is raising funds to help Catholics in Israel, Jordan, and Palestine. Previously, Detroit Catholics raised more than $460,000 for Gaza. Catholics continue to face severe persecution in both Nigeria and Iraq, though the specific dynamics differ in each country. In Nigeria, the violence is primarily driven by various militant groups in the Muslim-majority North and Middle Belt regions, while in Iraq, Christians face ongoing displacement due to the actions of groups like ISIS. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales attended a panel discussion focusing on what Catholics face. Eric.
Good evening, Veronica. Right now, a number of bills are making their way through Congress aimed at stopping the persecution of Catholics, specifically in Nigeria and Iraq, where many say a genocide is taking place. Recently, I attended an event sponsored by the Knights of Columbus, an eye-opening session with Catholic priests and others who are on the ground and have witnessed the murder and violent acts against the faithful.
You can see here the common calling card that ISIS left behind is a decapitated statue of Mary with both hands cut off.
Stephen Rocha is the director of the Institute for Catholic Humanitarian Service at Franciscan University. After ISIS attacked northern Iraq in 2014, he worked as legal counsel for nearly 150,000 displaced Christians under the care of the Archdiocese of Erbil in Iraq. He tells me for 4 years he lived and worked among the people, documenting with photographs their struggles and pain.
All of these Christians living in these marginalized situations, they're human beings. You know, and our faith teaches us, above all else, the importance of the spark of human dignity that's in every one of us.
Father Karam Shamasha knows that struggle firsthand. He and thousands of others were driven from their parish by ISIS. Today, he says ISIS is not as strong but still exists, and Christians are persecuted through discrimination.
Thanks to God, we are still there. We are fighting to remain not just numbers in these countries, but we are fighting to, in fact, be a real member that can shine, that can give light to all the people that they are around.
Now, on to the topic of Nigeria.
During a panel discussion, Stephen Rocha also shared photographs of his work in Nigeria, where he helped run a Catholic healthcare facility and school. He says the mass kidnappings of women a few weeks ago happens all the time, often unreported.
The people are just living in absolute fear of their own personal safety, inability to move around, inability to farm, all of these things really just cascading right now.
Catholic priests agree and add the persecution is taking place through government policy, like establishing Sharia law, and through physical violence from militant Islamic groups like the Boko Haram.
Christians are killed, Christians are kidnapped, complete destruction of Christian schools and churches and hospitals. As I speak, even so many priests have been kidnapped and killed, and a lot of them are still with the kidnappers in the bushes.
Despite it all, Father says the faith in Nigeria grows stronger. The Catholic population is now estimated at 35 million. By the way, if you'd like to see Stephen Rocha's photographs for yourself, they will be on display at the St. John Paul II National Shrine right here in D.C. until February 5th. Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
President Donald Trump has introduced a nationwide savings initiative for children, calling the new Trump accounts a transformative path to long-term financial security. The program received a major boost with a $6.25 billion pledge from Michael and Susan Dell, the first private investment. At a White House event, the president praised the couple's contribution as an amazing act, adding that he plans to donate as well. The Dells say the accounts are designed to be simple, secure, and grow over time, giving every young American a financial foundation for education, job training, or home ownership when they turn 18. Tiana Lowe Doscher, economics columnist at the Washington Examiner, joins me now. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
What is the overarching goal of the new Trump accounts, and how do they work?
I think really you have an entire generation of young people. We're seeing right now they feel locked out of home ownership. They know they're paying for Social Security returns they're never going to get. This flips the script. This gives a future generation of some children that aren't even born yet skin in the game of the free market. Look, back in the Bush administration, when George W. Bush wanted to privatize Social Security, the argument was always that you'll get greater real returns than having the government keep the money in a slush fund. And look, AEI did the math, and they found that low-income workers would be receiving right now an 8% increase or 8% higher benefits for those that retire this year if Bush had been allowed to privatize Social Security. With these Trump accounts, you're talking about $1,000 directly from the government, and then Michael Dell is giving this other $250 to the first, you know, I think it's 80% of children in the country who are young right now in zip codes with a median income of less than $150,000. If you add nothing else to that account in 18 years, it's $7,000. You know, you're talking about over 5 times return on your investment. Now, let's say you have this account for 25 years, and each month, parents add in less than $50 a month, let's say $43 a month. That would amount to, in 25 years, $70,000, which is exactly what 20% down payment on the median priced home is today. It's just about making it so that way this next generation has skin in the game. One of the reasons why you have the Zoran Mamdanis on the left, lots of haters of capitalism able to win people over, is because people don't understand that the stock market nets 10% return. They don't understand that capital has greater returns on investment than labor does, and for good reason. And this is a way of democratizing access to the free market.
So often there's lots of ideas, but actually getting them to become a reality can be difficult. How significant is it that the $6.25 billion pledge from Michael and Susan Dell in launching this program?
It's honestly pretty unprecedented. And, you know, we see billionaire philanthropy can come in many forms. Sometimes it is productive, malaria nets and vaccine development. Sometimes it is wildly unproductive, as we see with, you know, a lot of the DEI fundraising. This is something incredibly novel because it's a gamble on the future. It's a gamble on saying we've had too many generations that have felt like the American dream is sliding away, who have not understood that, as Ben Franklin said, money makes money, right? That's one of the founding ethoses of this country. There's a reason why Albert Einstein called compound interest the eighth wonder of the world. And now this is Michael Dell banking on that, saying we're going to bring this back. We're going to take back a generation that, you know, has, again, Zoran Mamdani and these guys. It's not like they've caught fire for no reason. They're saying, let's bring it back. Instead of asking, oh, can the government give you a handout right now? Let's put in a small amount of money, put it in the market, see what it does over time. And then you can use it for a down payment on housing. You can use it for greater education. You can use it to start your own business. Mm.
Tiana Lo-Dosher, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, missionary saint. What a small town saint from Spain has to do with Catholicism in India. Plus, see a special mass said at one of the wonders of the world. The church celebrates the feast of St. Francis Xavier. Born in what is now modern-day Spain in 1506, he studied in Paris, where he met St. Ignatius of Loyola. The two were among the first founders of the Society of Jesus, or Jesuits. In 1540, he was appointed by the King of Portugal to evangelize the people of the East Indies. Over the next 10 years, he served as a missionary in Asia, primarily in India and Japan. He died in 1552 and was canonized in 1622 by Pope Gregory XV. St. Francis Xavier, pray for us. High above Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, the iconic Christ the Redeemer hosted a traditional Thanksgiving Mass marking the National Day of Samba. The celebration began with the Corcovado train transformed into the historic Samba train departing from the station. As Father Omar celebrated the Mass, he declared, "In Samba culture, you find values, love, respect. That's where God is." Samba artists sang during the service, performing alongside Father Omar and representatives from Rio's most traditional Samba schools. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, YouTube, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.